PD Pods present the PD Podscast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the PD Podscast, hosted by myself, Pranay Budev, a pediatric orthopedic surgeon from London, England. This month's episode is released with a heavy heart as we announce the passing of one of our own. Dr. Lucas Murnaghan was a paediatric orthopaedic specialist based at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, who had a subspecialty interest in managing paediatric athletes and undertook his specialist fellowship training in Canada at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne and the Texas Scottish Rite Hospital in Dallas. He was also very well known for his involvement in sporting activities, diving, and for most of all, for photography. For all of those that knew him and worked with him, he'll be sorely missed, and we dedicate this episode to him. In light of Dr. Murnaghan heralding from the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, I'm proud to release this month's episode, which was recorded last year prior to the COVID pandemic shutting down the world. At that time, he was the interim head of the orthopedic surgery department, and I would like to congratulate him on him being formally appointed to the head of the department earlier last month. Dr. Andrew Howard has interest in trauma, rare disease, and skeletal dysplasias, and has a master's of epidemiology, focusing on injury prevention in the pediatric population. He also works with the University of Toronto with regards to their global health outreach programs, and we'll be talking to him about all of these different topics in addition to what it was like at that time developing a high-functioning team at one of the most prestigious hospital units in the world. I hope you enjoy the episode. Let's get into it. Another interview brought from Toronto in Canada. I'm sitting with Dr. Andrew Howard, who's the current division head at Hospital for Sick Children. He's a professor at the Department of Surgery, Health Policy, Management and Evaluation, and I'm very lucky to sit down with him and talk to him about his career and his research interests, etc. So thank you very much for sitting with me.
Thank you, Pranay.
So tell me about your training, because Andrew Howard is not a Canadian name, but obviously you were training here, I believe.
All names are Canadian names, but yes, I am a first generation immigrant to Canada. My parents grew up in England. Both of them are doctors. They ended up working in a small town in northwestern Alberta. One as a general surgeon, and really my father's entire clinical life was practicing in a what was a remote setting when he started and isn't a remote setting anymore because the world grows. I've done all of my training in Canada, and prior to medical school I did a degree in mathematics.
And where did you do your medical school training, residency and fellowships, your sort of career path, to say?
So after finishing high school, which was in High Prairie, Alberta, I went to a small university called Queen's University, which is in Kingston in Ontario. Big university, small town, Scottish heritage, and I stayed there for 11 years, during which time I got a degree in mathematics, a degree in medicine, a residency in orthopedic surgery, got married to my wife, and bought a house.
So very busy time, as you can imagine.
Yeah, a long time there, yes.
And how did you end up at SickKids?
So I actually came to SickKids in 1989 as a medical student. I wrote Bob Salter a letter with a typewriter indicating that I was interested in children's orthopedics, and Bob Salter, being busy, passed it on to Mercer Rang. And Mercer Rang, being gracious, offered me what was obviously a very determining month of elective in my life. And then Mercer Rang, being elegant and with a quirky little sense of humor, when he moved out of his office and I moved into my office in 1999, a decade later, this little letter that I'd written as a medical student was taped to the door.
And good humoured, as I recognise it from all his books.
He highlighted the, I think I would like to do children's orthopaedics as a career.
Well, it's nice to know it almost came full circle. And he did acknowledge you actually in one of his books at the beginning as one of the, in the Art of Orthopaedics, I think, or the History of Orthopaedics. I saw your name in there.
I think that was for translating some things from French into English for him.
Fair enough. So what is your clinical practice now entail?
I've always liked trauma, and I continue to like trauma. And the rest of what I'm doing now I lump together and describe as rare conditions. So a lot of my elective patients are patients with skeletal dysplasias, or patients with osteogenesis imperfecta, or patients with other metabolic and endocrine things, X-linked rickets. Where the skeleton is intrinsically abnormal, and where there is medical as well as surgical treatment, or genetic as well as surgical investigation.
And does that involve, obviously, a limb reconstruction element as well as sort of, because I know at SickKids, the faculty tend to be very, very specialized in their area, which is great for patients and for fellows and trainees that come through the program.
Yeah. Limb reconstruction, taken broadly, includes anything that we do for these patients to straighten them out. Limb reconstruction taken narrowly is saying, do we use external fixators and frames? I tend to share the frame practice with my colleagues and that away. But I'm doing most of the growing rods, a lot of the guided growth, a lot of the osteotomies that are done acutely and things like that for that population.
And is there a sort of MDT society in Canada for these patients? So we have the Skeletal Dysplasia Group in the UK. There's obviously the International Skeletal Dysplasia Society. Does Canada have something along those lines?
Canada has 35 million people total. And so I think most of the people who are interested in skeletal dysplasias would fit in the same 15-passenger van in this country. We tend to go to the International Skeletal Dysplasia Society for the academic portion of that practice.
Okay, fine. And I know you did a master's in epidemiology, which sort of takes us on to research, because you sort of describe yourself as an injury control researcher, which is why I was so excited to speak to you, because I don't know of any other pediatric orthopedic surgeons that have sort of research interest in injury prevention. So tell me how that sort of, what stimulated you to go down that path of research?
Well, the flip answer is you're trying to work yourself out of a job. You know, if you get the day part of it right, then you don't have to do the nighttime part of it and look after fractures anymore at all. It comes from looking at what makes populations well as what takes the health away from child populations. And in most countries in the world, injury is the leading cause of death once you've made it up to your first birthday. And from there up until age 45, age 30, it depends what country you're in. But for children and youth, injury is it if they're going to lose their health. And that applies whether you're in a high-income country or a low- and middle-income country. The epidemiology is different in low- and middle-income countries, and we're going to get onto that later, but I'll tell you what's interesting about it in high-income countries. Nobody actually needs to die of a road traffic crash in England, Canada, North America. And nobody actually needs to understand about an infection or about human DNA or about degeneration. There's no, these injuries are an epiphenomenon. They're an epiphenomenon, they're an accidental byproduct of the way that human beings have designed systems to do with energy and time and motion. And because we made the problem, and most of it accounts for this banal thing called road transportation, it's actually within our control to completely unmake the problem as well. While we've been successful in some areas, like protecting the occupants of cars significantly better as the years go by, we've been unsuccessful in other areas, like protecting child pedestrians and cyclists from being struck by the front of cars. But there's work to be done And there are successful interventions at every conceivable level. And so what we focus on from the epidemiology perspective is we say, is there an intervention to evaluate? And are there injury outcomes that we can actually measure and test? And then we can provide information back into the community and get better at winnowing away what is in fact the leading cause of death for children.
Can you give an example, because you've published on this, so give an example to the audience about sort of what things you noticed from some of your studies and how it's actually been implemented at sort of local and governmental level.
So in Canada, one of the things that we've seen over the past two decades is a significant reduction in the number of children who die as motor vehicle occupants. And when I started looking at this in 1996, we started with some investigations into the biomechanics of injuries to the central nervous system primarily that children suffer when they're occupants in high-speed motor vehicle crashes. How do you manage to hurt your cervical spine? How do you manage to hurt your brain? How do you manage to hurt the rest of your spinal column? At that time, the chances of a severe injury for a child in the back seat of a vehicle were often higher in certain crashes than the chances of a severe injury to the average adult male in the driver's seat of that car, which is silly because the driver's seat is closer to the crash and there's a steering wheel in front of it. But all of the biomechanical collision mitigation has been designed into the system against where the larger numbers are. When you turn your focus to the smaller numbers and you say, now we understand how this child struck their head in a side impact crash, now we understand how this child hurt their neck in either a rollover crash or some type of inertial one, then you can start to change the internal biomechanics. And you can see that the child safety seats have changed all over the world. They've changed in Canada in the past couple of decades. We had the good fortune of working with a large network that was funded out of Industry Canada and that looked at all sorts of outcomes about the automotive industry with safety as an important but integrated part of it. And I think the attraction there was that once we understood what the problems were and what the potential solutions were, we ended up mocking up all kinds of crashes in software and then designing mitigation strategies, testing those in software, and ultimately those came out into the real world as all sorts of innovations that go into child safety seats. The harnesses are better, the orientation of the seat is better, the seats are better attached to the cars now rather than being retained by a seat belt. They're held with these latch mechanism things. There are means of riding down the crash and creating a longer, blunter crash curve for a child in a car seat by having load-limiting tethers or crushable elements within the seat base itself. And there are ways of putting the equivalent of bicycle helmet foam between the child's head and something that might injure it. All of these things taken together have improved the biomechanics of colliding as a child inside a car, and that, as well as other collision avoidance and other technologies that have come down to children, have meant that we're now on a downward trend, a very significant downward trend for severe injuries and deaths inside the vehicle.
Yeah, which is amazing. And then the other part is obviously where these children present to. Now, SickKids is a very, very busy hospital for trauma, and I was at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, and that was a very busy hospital for trauma in the state of Victoria.
Yeah.
How have things changed with regards to emergency trauma care for children, obviously when they are miles away? Are they being put in a chopper and brought to SickKids, or are they being treated locally? And is there evidence to show that they get a better outcome if they're treated locally?
So we have got to the point that I would say significant road trauma in children is a small enough number and a rare enough event that it is actually difficult to make the same kinds of studies and the same kinds of comparisons as you can do with adult trauma. The questions that obtain in trauma care have to do with functioning as a system, which most places definitely do, and Ontario does. And then working out within that system how to move patients efficiently from one place to the next. And if you're in the middle of a congested city like we are, then at a certain distance, air transfer is preferable for getting people to a higher level of care. There isn't a helicopter to scene response in Ontario primarily. Primarily what happens is people go in a land vehicle to the resuscitation hospital, which is the nearest suitably equipped, and then they'll come in an air vehicle to a trauma center really promptly within the initial resuscitation if that is most appropriate for where the resuscitation continues.
And moving away from the road traffic accident type research, you've also done things on playground injuries, which is very, very common. I mean, the number of patients we see from trampolining injuries is horrendous. Tell us a bit about the work you've done on playground equipment.
Well, the playground equipment was a succession of studies which culminated in actually being able to do a randomized trial in injury prevention. And it's difficult to put scientific design into injury prevention. We were working with the Toronto District School Board. They had a lot of playgrounds at hundreds of different primary schools, elementary schools, that they were responsible for. And what had happened is they had taken away a lot of the equipment that was severely non-complying with standards. They had left some of the equipment that was sort of newer and okay, and they had an in-between group of schools. We looked at whether the equipment that they took away had actually been causing injuries in the first place. And we looked at the effects of replacing it with equipment that complied. And we found out that their program was able to identify dangerous equipment that actually had a higher injury rate. And we were also able to identify that replacing it with complying equipment caused the injury rate to drop. So then we made friends with the school board. And we said, what about these in-between schools? What about a randomized study? You know, now when you're getting around to the second worst group of schools, why don't we randomize between the impact absorbing engineered wood fiber versus a granitic type of sand, a high quality sand? These are just loose fill surfaces to loose fill surfaces that compete. You and I know that we would dive for a volleyball in sand and we would slide, and that the bending mechanism that produces a fracture is less likely. And you and I know that that bending mechanism and the friction is a little bit different if you're on a different kind of loose fill surface. So we had this hypothesis that they might perform differently in terms of fractures. They are mechanically equivalent in terms of head form drops and protecting against head injury, which is probably the most important thing that you do on the playground. So we set up a randomized trial. We used fracture rates as the primary outcome. We found a 3 to 5-fold difference in which the sand, which allows the friction and the sliding out of the fall to be absorbed and doesn't result in fractures. And we published that actually in a leading medical journal. And then it didn't go anywhere very much, because it turns out that at the local school level, things like somebody worrying about cats fouling the sandbox or the janitor saying, I have to clean up the mess in the school, are at least as loud a voice as evidence when it comes to how are we going to protect kids in the playground.
Yeah, and this sort of evidence-based and injury research is quite interesting. I think recently I saw a paper where they looked at hoverboard injuries for children. I can't remember what North American Institute it was, but you know, they were looking at very much at this. Let's move on to something I really want to talk to you about, which is global health and your role in helping improve, you know, the treatment of orthopedic conditions around the world, especially in the developing world. You're the director of the Office of International Surgery, and know the University of Toronto is very much involved in this. Tell me about the sort of mission, the goal, and what's been done.
So that started for me as a stem from the injury control work. It doesn't take very long to work out that the place where most of the children who are being injured in road traffic or elsewhere, the place where the real problem lies is in low and middle income countries rather than in high income countries. So rather naively, I set off in 2003 to collaborate with a colleague who was a pediatric general surgeon in Uganda. And we proposed a randomized trial of the Ugandan national curriculum for teaching children to cross the road. I submitted to her that I thought this was an inappropriate response to a pedestrian problem in Uganda, and she submitted to me that if we could get some money together to actually implement this curriculum, that maybe we would be doing something and at least we would be finding something out. So that was where the global surgery involvement started. Although the trial never got funded, we did do a little bit of injury control work, and then I became distracted with this rational thought that while the injury rages on in low and middle income countries, perhaps the best thing that an orthopedic surgeon can do is treat some of the injured, or in the case of an academic, improve other people's capacity to treat the injured. So that's how we came to be involved in the training, the evaluation, the provision of training materials, and ultimately some structured programs for residents and fellows and things like that.
And you said the University of Toronto have this whole sort of area now of the Office for International Surgery. How is that funded? What's the involvement of NGOs? And who is the sort of faculty made up of? It's not just yourself as an orthopedic surgeon. I'm sure there's multiple specialties. And which countries are they sort of working in at the moment?
Yeah. So international surgery or global surgery is something that is part of the University of Toronto in the same way that doing research as a surgeon is part of the university. Doesn't say, here's your money, here's your grant, but the university does say, if you go out and get grants and generate resources, then we will value that as scholarly activity. And it can be something that you are evaluated on. You can be even be promoted for doing that here. And that is in response to what the world needs, as well as in response to what the students need. And that enables people across all of the surgical faculties to carry on projects of various sorts, whether they are investigating a certain condition that might be different in a lower middle income country, whether they're trying to build some surgical capacity around a specific population, whatever it is they're trying to do. There's considerable scholarly latitude in addressing this problem that surgical technology is not available around the world, and surgical training is not available around the world in proportion to, you know, where the patients are who are suffering from things. I mean, I think you know this yourself from your forays into Tanzania. What's the role of the NGO in that? I think of the role of the NGO in global surgery as equivalent to the role of the hospital in scholarly surgery, right? We all work for universities where we train people and come up with ideas. Those universities could not exist or carry out that mission without a clinical partner that allows them to get on with it and actually treat some patients. In a similar way, I don't think that a university in a high-income country is going to be a place that is going to directly provide care or infrastructure for patients in low and middle income countries, but it is an excellent collaborator for the other things that are the output of universities, which are trained people and ideas about how to do things properly.
And both you and I have worked in some of these countries, and we've gone and spent some little time in these countries. What do you think our role is as clinicians when we visit these places? You know, sometimes you turn up with all the best intentions of doing something, but there's no point treating a bunch of patients which you are not going to follow up. The infrastructure is completely different, and actually it may even be that actually education is the most valuable thing that we can offer. And I know that the University of Toronto has done things through certain projects like the Ptolemy project, sharing medical resources. Tell me about your thoughts on these.
Yeah, people talk about leave skills, not scars. People talk about having partnerships somewhere. I think the surgical problems of patients in Africa are going to be solved by African surgeons who have trained in Africa. And then you look at the institutions that are participating in that training, and those include some universities and some large hospitals, and an organization that's one of my favorites, the College of Surgeons of East, Central, and Southern Africa. That's a transnational college of surgeons who both accredits training programs and gives examinations to evaluate the final outcome. That model has been very successful in bringing a growing cadre of locally trained surgeons into the African region. Very early on, when there was difficult access to library resources, we started at University of Toronto a little project with our library to share full-text library access with the trainers and the trainees through the COSEXA program. That was called the Ptolemy Project. Unfortunately, that project itself has sunset. We're looking at different ways of rekindling it for thousands of people or tens of thousands rather than for hundreds of people. But information is power, and sharing it is very, very enabling.
Yeah, and the and the penetrance of sort of mobile usage in Africa has surged in the last 10 years, and I'm sure there must be opportunities with sort of web-based learning and app-based learning now, because it's amazing when you go now that everyone has a smartphone. They may not have a decent roof over their heads, but they have a smartphone.
That's true, and that creates all kinds of opportunities, not just for doctor to doctor, how do you learn, but people are using that to replace clinical transfers. One of my colleagues at the University of Toronto, Alan Rogers, works in Southern Africa, and he has shown that you can reduce transfers for burn care by more than two-thirds and improve clinical outcomes by using app-based communication from specialist to local doctor. There are people who are using this technology in order to get patient follow-up. There are large consortia, so we just had Ewan Harrison here from Edinburgh talking about looking at crowdsourcing information on surgical outcomes within the first 30 days from hundreds of countries in the world, from little hospitals everywhere. So this information technology has made global surgery a much more viable type of scalable project, whether you're talking about the educational things or the research things that you can do.
And tell me a bit about the Bethune Roundtable, because that's something that's based in Canada, but it's very much about global surgery.
So that's a meeting that is, I believe, in its 19th year now, 18th or 19th year. The Bethune meeting for 2020 is running in Winnipeg, Manitoba, between May 28th and 31st. The focus there is going to be on the health of Indigenous and Aboriginal peoples, which is part of global surgery around the world, and which is an example of the fact that in a country like Canada, you don't need to travel very far to address some of the social issues, the inequity issues, and the lack of access issues that we see with surgical care and accordingly with the health outcomes. That meeting started out with a principle that we wanted everybody's ideas. And so part of running that meeting means raising some scholarship money so that people who have their abstract accepted can be sponsored to attend if they come from a lower middle income country and their own organization can't pay. And that's made a nice mix for that meeting, so that we meet people from high income countries who have projects and partners, and we meet people from low income countries who have projects and ideas. And it allows a very good dialogue and development then of global surgery.
Fantastic. Let's move on to your role as a division head of orthopedics. SickKids is definitely renowned as probably one of the most famous or well-recognized hospitals in the world for trauma and orthopedics for children. What makes the department so well-regarded? I know a lot more than most of the listeners will about this. So why don't you just explain why do you think it's so well known?
So this is a nice hospital to work in. And the reason that this is a nice hospital to work in is that it is in a big city that people come to from everywhere. The mixture of people in Toronto is really from everywhere in the world. And the province of Ontario, which is 13 million people, comes to this hospital for their tertiary and quaternary level orthopedic care. So the type of practice that we see here is very highly selected and concentrated. It's like being at the end of a funnel, and that makes it an excellent place to learn about things. But the mixture of faculty and trainees that we get is reflective of the mixture of the world's population that comes to Toronto. Typically, we have five clinical fellows training here at any given time, and that will be two people from within North America and three people from somewhere else in the world. And it's that mix within small numbers of people as well as within large numbers of people that allows us really, I think, to keep in contact with the ideas that come from everywhere and to try and keep up with this thing that we call children's orthopedics that otherwise, you know, grows faster than any of us.
And as the head of a unit, how do you get the best out of the faculty? Because people come with their own life experiences, their own desires, what they were trying to get out of their jobs and all this. And I know it's a salaried position here. It's not a fee-for-service as a lot of other places are in Ontario. So tell me what attracts that and how do you try and get the best out of the faculty? Or do you think they're all just, they're senior now, they've been appointed and now you're sort of taking over at a point where that's not as much of the case as it may have been previously?
I think there is a tremendous amount of opportunity here, and I think the key to this place as far as the faculty are concerned is that we've got a strong university that we are all appointed to. We've got a strong research institute with collaborators that we are connected to, or with a lot of surgeon scientists and surgeon investigators in the faculty here. And so as well as having a very concentrated and sometimes very focused clinical practice, everybody here has the opportunity to have a very concentrated and very focused scholarly practice as well. And it honestly, I think it is that mix for the faculty. And then the idea of getting the best out of people is to allow them to pursue what really motivates them and what they're actually really very good at. And there's a lot of talent here. And so I think that's what keeps things exciting and moving forwards.
So in your opinion nowadays, what would you say is the favorite part of your job as a division head, but also as a surgeon at Sick Kids? And what's your least favorite part?
Well, I think it isn't fair asking children's orthopedic surgeons what their favorite part of the job is, because for most of us, I think that's the same answer. For most of us, it's actually dealing with the children, right? I do tell my trainees, you know, in their fourth and fifth year of residency, go back to the adult hospital, walk up and down the clinic hallway, listen for laughter. It's a different setting, you know. Children's hospitals are fun places. And we meet a lot of very interesting children and families, and we get good clinical outcomes by and large by working with them. So as a surgeon, that has to be the favorite part of the job. As a researcher, it's actually kind of fun to see something change in the real world based on some ideas that you have helped to develop. And I think that's something that has happened repeatedly out of the faculty of this institution. And so that's a legacy that's nice to have, but it's also sort of a challenge for the future. And it creates the Red Queen problem of having to run faster and faster just in order to stand still. But that's that is all in good fun. Are there least favorite parts of the job? Well, under coins with two sides of them, we did just computerize, and that has to an extent slowed us down, and also to an extent, wouldn't say that it's bottled up the flow of information, but it has not liberated the flow of information to the extent that one would assume is available or natural or obvious. And so I think we have some work to do there. There's no question about which way the world is going, and there's no question that there are advantages to doing everything with connected data sets and databases and so on and so forth. And there are some unique things about health data and privacy, confidentiality, everything else like that. But there are also some very banal things about how these things get imposed for either clinical or educational or research outcomes, that it turns out we need to work our way through in order to take advantage of what we should be able to take advantage of.
And there's plenty of data now showing that these electronic medical records actually increase physician burnout and physician stress, and because there's constant activity and constant communication, and you can check things from your smartphone at home, and people find it time. So with all that taken into consideration, how do you spend your sort of time away from the hospital? In how do you relax, de-stress, and maintain your sanity?
If you talk to people close to me, I'm not sure that they say I do. I do think that work-life balance is important. I've got a wonderful wife and two wonderful daughters, all of whom share my enthusiasm for human-powered transportation outdoors. And if you're Canadian, you know that we've got four seasons. My favorite might be winter. And so we like to get out and do some cross-country skiing or some downhill skiing. But if it all melts away and happens to be summer, then you will find us hiking or paddling or doing something like that. It doesn't take very long in the wilderness or in the trees to come back with a little bit of a sense of perspective about, how exciting work is and how fresh you feel. I think the other thing that does allow people to put the day-to-day difficulties of a big hospital like this in perspective are to do what you do. I know you go to Moi in Tanzania. I always find that if I've come back from Ethiopia, where you can say, some people do have real problems in their patients and with their infrastructure and with their clinical practice, and you see people thriving as surgeons in all kinds of settings where the resource constraints, which are something that we are always thinking about no matter where we are, but if you come from a place where the resource constraints are very, very significant, and you come back to a hospital like this one, you realize that the problems that you have should be wrapped in a certain perspective about the world.
Yeah, and it sounds very corny, but one of my favorite quotes is from Picasso, and he goes, the meaning of your life is to find talent, and the purpose of your life is to give it away. And I feel like when we go away to these other institutions and we're able to sort of give this talent away without expectation, that brings a sort of relaxation in us and appreciation of our own lives and where we live and everything else.
Oh, I think the other thing that happens if you do travel is you meet people who are tremendously talented and in some ways kind of over-determined to succeed no matter what. And then you find out that there's a little bit of what comes from here or a little bit of what comes from there that it can enable or contribute to other people's success. And that in itself is very, very rewarding and very energizing. But the talent pool on the planet didn't get trapped into the high-income countries at the time of everybody's birth. And so when you look at this potential for surgery to actually spread and be available to all of the patients who are lacking it, the potential is there. The organizational structure is something that's going to require some creativity and a bunch of stuff to happen on behalf of various governments, health ministries, things like that. So it's not all entirely in anybody's control, certainly not in mine or yours. But on the other hand, without a meaningful participation from the profession, none of this is going to go on. And with a meaningful participation from the profession, the sky's the limit, you know, in terms of patients touched.
I think that's a beautiful place to end the sort of interview. I think we've gone through a lot there with regards to how you began your training, your role in sort of injury research, how you helping change the approach to global treatment of these, and obviously your role as the division head. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. It was great to sit down with you.
Pranay, it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.